Good afternoon. I want to call the meeting of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee to order. It's Monday, February 14th. And I know we still have a few members who are making their way here, but I wanted to at least begin. And just as a reminder, last time we met, we were hearing presentations about the mental health programs in the state, and there were some people that wanted to offer some testimony that we didn't have time to get to, and I suggested that if they could come back today that we would hear their presentation. And there are also, I believe, some questions from members of the committee that we may want to take as well. So we'll do that, and then we've also asked for the Department of Human Services to come today to talk about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So we'll hear a little briefing on that as well. So to begin, I'd like to ask if Karen Ephraim would like to make her way to the Dr. Ephraim, I'm sorry, apologize. And welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim. I am a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for Education Liberty Watch, and I serve on the board of the Alliance for Human Research Protection and the International Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. I'm here today to talk about the significant concerns with the over and inappropriate use of psychiatric drugs and that relationship to the screening programs that are in place in the state and their effects, especially on the most vulnerable children in our state, particularly those in juvenile justice and foster care. I want to let you know that although I'm going to focus mostly on antipsychotic drugs, I could say similar things about the overuse of antidepressants and attention deficit disorder drugs as well. And the handout that you received today, which was a supplement to what I had provided last week, has data at the end on the ADHD drugs and the antidepressants, as well as the full references to many of the quotes I used in my PowerPoint, as well as others. Proponents of screening and childhood early mental health intervention justify their programs by making statements to the public and policymakers, and I'm speaking from the PowerPoint presentation that you had from last week, just so you know. Things like mental illnesses or biological brain disorders, or more than half of Americans will develop a mental illness in their lifetime, often beginning in childhood or adolescence, which, if you think about it, seems quite absurd on its face that one in two of us will have a mental illness during our lifetimes. The department testified last week that 70% of adolescents in juvenile justice placements have diagnosable psychiatric illnesses. And there is now a proposal for what's called a pre-psychotic disorder in the new version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that's coming out in 2012 or 2013, when even the research that they're basing that on says that only 25% of those people will develop full-blown psychosis. The next slide is a list of the mental health screening programs that are in place in Minnesota. The top four are under the purview of this committee: the Juvenile Justice, Child Welfare, Foster Care, the MFIP pilot program, which I think is gone, at least I hope so, and the school-based mental health infrastructure through the grants that was described last week. The next slide talks about the increase in mental health screening of juvenile justice and foster care. from 2005 to 2008, and that graph is taken from the agency profile provided by the department to the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget. And over those years, there's been a 57% increase in mental health screening of those children. I received data from the same period from the Department of Human Services of prescriptions for antipsychotic medications for Minnesota children covered by fee-for-service Medicaid. And although it's not an exact correlation, almost all of the children in juvenile justice and foster care receive their prescriptions and their services through Medicaid. So it's a rough indication of the increase in prescriptions for these drugs for those children. It's not only those children, but it's at least a rough indicator. And you can see that that's gone up by 34% over that time. And that's actually a small increase if you look at the data that was analyzed by the New York Times of Minnesota physicians, who found that from 2000 to 2005, the payments of pharmaceutical industry to psychiatrists in Minnesota increased sixfold, and antipsychotic prescriptions paid for by Medicaid for children under 18 increased by ninefold from 2000 to 2005. And that was in a New York Times article that was published in 2007. The report that the department sends to the Center for Medicaid Services found that 428 children receiving Medicare prescriptions received an antipsychotic prescription without the FDA-approved diagnosis of bipolar disease, schizophrenia, or major depressive disorder. 360 children were receiving a drug for ADHD without that diagnosis, and 330 children were receiving four or more psychiatric medications at once.
Dr. Ephraim, can I just interrupt just to clarify here? So this report that you mentioned, where these data are from, is the department saying that there are 428 children, for example, that are receiving medication without the right diagnosis? Is that their words?
Yes. The Drug Utilization Review Report that is required by law to be sent to the Department of, to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Center for Medicaid Services. And this is a copy of those pages of involving the children under 18.
Thank you.
And it has the graphs and the tables where I took those numbers. Eighteen children under 4 years of age were receiving psychotropic drugs for which there are no FDA-approved indications. And 15 children were inappropriately receiving the antipsychotic aripiprazole for treatment of depression. That's 1,139 unique children over a six-month period from 2008 to 2009. And the projected costs over 1 year of those inappropriate prescriptions to the taxpayers of Minnesota was over $2 million. This is especially concerning for antipsychotics because these drugs are very dangerous, especially for children. The next slides talk about the study that found 45 deaths in children due to antipsychotic toxicity, and that probably only represents 1 to 10% of the total deaths. It was mentioned by the department last week that the lifespan of people diagnosed with schizophrenia, and these are adults, is shortened by 25 years, and it is felt largely due to these medications. and the metabolic and endocrine effects and other dangerous side effects are greatly magnified in children. There's a black box warning for suicide in children from these drugs, and there's a syndrome called neuroleptic malignant syndrome that can kill children within 24 hours. Nearly 60% of children take antipsychotics have severe neurological problems, and as I said, they're more at risk from the metabolic and endocrine problems, including male breast development that actually has required surgery. And in a study that just came out a week ago, 211 adults newly diagnosed schizophrenic were followed as they were treated with antipsychotics, and there was a clear loss of brain volume that was due to the drugs and not due to any other factor. And the document I gave you today has the actual abstract that explained the results. Rebecca Riley was diagnosed bipolar at age 2.5 and treated by a Harvard psychiatrist with a cocktail of 4 different drugs, including an antipsychotic, and died at age 4. These treatments are ineffective for children. According to the European Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, they don't work, and they're very expensive. The CADI trials, which were done in adults, found that the newer antipsychotics have staggering side effect profiles and high rates of discontinuation because of the side effects, and therefore are not effective. Professor March and Stephen Hyman have both, and the quotes are there for you to look at, talk about the absolute dangers of these children, or of these drugs for children. And the number of antipsychotic prescriptions is increasing throughout the whole country, and that is clarified in the slide that's titled "The Problems with Screening is That Treatment Equal Drugs." In addition, in the states where it's been studied, Massachusetts, Texas, and Florida, 50 to 65% of foster children are on antipsychotic drugs and psychotropic drugs. And there are lawsuits moving through several states that the use of these drugs without indication and because of their high dangerous side effects is actually Medicaid fraud. Opinion leaders seem to think that psychopharmacology can actually be used as preventive therapy for children with genetic susceptibility to mental health problems. The only problem is that there have been few, if any, studies that actually show a genetic link of any mental illness. So to use these preventatively would be the height of poor medicine. The problem is that the DSM-IV broadened, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual provided by the American Psychiatric Association, actually broadened psychiatric diagnoses, particularly bipolar in children, in the 1994 edition, and bipolar diagnoses among children have increased over 40-fold. Psychiatric experts are rueing that diagnosis and that entry into the manual because there really isn't good evidence that's a valid diagnosis in children. The graph that's titled Child Hospitalizations Rise for Bipolar Disease notes that the increase was especially steep from 2000 through 2004 for African American youngsters And these are, unfortunately, many of the kids that receive these drugs through Medicaid.
Doctor, excuse me, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ephraim, is this rise due to better diagnosis and these children are being having testing and they're being diagnosed, or is it just happens to be a genetic issue? Or
it's
Dr. Ephraim.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon.
Senator Rosen.
Rosen. It is because it has been broadened, and the editor of the fourth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual actually sees that as an enormous mistake that has had huge implications for the health and well-being of children. The diagnostic categories are just not very good for children and bipolar. And because the editors, the group for this disorder made that determination back in 1994, it has increased rapidly. And it has also increased because opinion leaders like Dr. Joseph Biederman of Harvard believes that that's so and failed to disclose that he received over $1 million from one of the drug companies that makes antipsychotics.
Thank you. And go ahead. I want to encourage you to be fairly concise here. We do have another testifier, and so please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will. The next four slides are about the some of the screening instruments that are used in children, giving you some examples of the questions, which are not exactly scientific, as well as the statistical evidence that the positive predictive value of these is very low, in that in 100 children, 27 for the ages and stages are actually have the diagnosis when and the rest 73% that are referred for further diagnosis do not. And if you did that with a medical test for a physical ailment, you would either be sued or laughed out of existence to have that high a false positive rate. The next several slides, and I won't go through them in detail, but they all list quotes from very respected sources in mental health and psychiatry of the absolute uncertainty of the diagnosis. So if you're wanting to do a screening test that are based on diagnostic criteria that have this much controversy and this much lack of consensus and disagreement, you're actually spending, you're making some dangerous assumptions. Therefore, our recommendations are to delete these screening programs because they aren't very scientific and they're leading to unjustifiable diagnoses and unjustifiable drugging of children with serious medical, if not fatal, consequences. We should make the screening opt-in with informed consent about the potential for these diagnoses and drugs. We should enforce notification of parents' option to decline the preschool screening, which is already in law, but which they aren't notified of. And then I wanted to thank and commend Senator Berglund and the 2009 legislature for putting into law statute 256B.0625, which you mentioned last week, that requires a consultative psychiatric diagnosis before the use of these drugs for Medicaid children. I think that's an incredibly good step. However, given the seriousness of the harmful, if not fatal, side effects of these drugs and the overuse of them and our fiscal situation, I don't think it's enough. And therefore, we're making the other recommendations that you see listed in the last couple of slides. And the other recommendation that I should have put is that we have to promote two-parent family formation, because 63% of suicides, according to the FBI, are from people from single-parent families. 75% of teen chemical dependencies, according to the CDC, are from single-parent families, and greater than 50% of the juvenile crime are from the Children's Defense Fund. These kids aren't mentally ill. They are stressed. They have horrible family situations. They need help. In the words of Jesse Jackson, they need hugs, not drugs. They need hope, not dope, whether it's legal or illegal drugs. And I think it is our obligation, moral obligation and fiscal obligation as a state and you as policymakers, to make sure that we aren't hurting these kids in our efforts to help them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. I just want to make sure I understand your recommendations. Essentially, as you're testifying here and your argument that you're making is that there's a linkage between the screenings that we do and the use of the drugs. You're calling into question the validity of the drug usage, and you've pointed out some information even from the department that points to that there are some potential acknowledgement of misuse of psychotic drugs or antipsychotic drugs, and especially in children. So you're suggesting that we, in effect, do something on the screening end. In your view, that would tend to diminish the opportunity to prescribe drugs as treatments if the screenings are maybe improved or, in some cases, eliminated. Is that essentially your recommendation?
Right. Mr. Chairman, I do believe that the screening is essentially a dragnet, that it isn't scientific enough, and that we're labeling kids, especially in juvenile justice and foster care, that aren't mentally ill but that just need help. They need therapy. They need family help. They need all sorts of other things, but they don't need labels and they don't need drugs. And then the other part of the recommendation is to strengthen the limitations on paying for these drugs through Medicaid, which the state has to deal with. It's $4.5 million for screening. It's $2 million for the inappropriate use. And it's several million more for the other grants that are related.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Ephraim? Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate your patience and being willing to come back today. I apologize we couldn't hear your testimony last week, but appreciate your coming back. And
well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And I'd like to invite Sue Abner-Holden, if she's ready, to come up. And I do want to note for the record that we have a quorum. So thank you, Ms. Abner-Holden, for coming today. And again, I apologize for not being able to accommodate your presence on, I guess it was Wednesday last week, but appreciate you coming back. And please identify yourself and tell us what you want to tell us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sue Abner-Holden. I'm the executive director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota, and we're an advocacy organization that provides education, support, and advocacy for both children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member. You should have received information from NAMI volunteers last week on adult mental health services, kind of explaining the funding streams and some of the outcome data. And we do know that when we provide community services, we're able to treat and support people in the community, and we're able to prevent the use of more intensive and higher cost options, such as hospitalizations. Today we have material on children's mental health, but first I'd just like to make a few remarks in light of the previous testimony. I did hand out some information from NAMI that I guess we disagree with some of the data in terms of how it was presented, and so we have given you some more information, putting some quotes in context. It says information used by Education Liberty Watch, and then the rest of the story. It looks like this.
Is this the handout that's titled Latest News in Mental Health Research?
No, there should be another one. Sorry, that's...
I see. Yes.
And just a quick to point out that the Surgeon General and the National Institute of Mental Health both strongly believe mental illnesses are in fact real and that they have a biological basis. We also have information on the drug utilization review. I think it's important to know that the DUR is actually a method to bring to light the issues of medications. And once that letter went out, that the medication use actually dropped pretty dramatically because of that letter. And I think another very important thing to note is that most of the prescriptions for children are not prescribed by mental health professionals, but by your local family physician. And what we have found in some recent data that for children who actually went through screening because they got referred to a mental health professional, that actually fewer medications were prescribed. So I think in effect that if you have screening and people are getting into the mental health system, they're actually getting higher quality and not just simply going and using medication. We also have some other information in here about scientific research about disagreeing in terms of decreased brain volume. The black box warning certainly came out, but we've also found that suicides among young people have increased. And then there's additional information about, we've been working on screening issues for a long time, and it used to be that we were told that since the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force didn't recommend screening, that then it wasn't a good thing to do. They now have recommended screening. That was the very body that we were told we had to wait till they came out, and they have recommended it. And there's just some additional information on there. The last decade we've really seen a lot of more information on research on mental illnesses, including PET scans, imaging, blood tests, and more. And here at the Minneapolis VA, Dr. Georgilopoulos is conducting groundbreaking research on the use of magnetoencephalography machine that's actually identifying people with post-traumatic stress disorder by analyzing their brain signals. So this is a whole new area of research, and I don't think we can depend on materials that were written in 2000 or 2001 to be able to really inform us about what research is happening right now. And I think most of us recognize the stress that our veterans, experience when they've been in combat and overseas. And I would think that we would also understand that children who've been abused or neglected would experience similar type of stresses and would also develop PTSD. So again, I just off the internet today just pulled a couple of research articles for you just to show kind of the wide range of research that's going on. And we now have technology that, by scanning the brain, we can actually see the structural differences. And, who knows, in 5 years, maybe we'll have a better test for mental illnesses. I think we've also focused a lot on quality the last couple of years. VHS actually developed a form to help ensure higher quality diagnostic assessments. We're now collecting outcome data. I guess I just want to mention that, mental illness is not a political issue. It affects all people, Republicans and Democrats alike, right wing or left wing. I think you can think of Senator Pete Domenici and Paul Wellstone joining together because they both had family members with mental illness. And I can tell you that pretty much every time I testify at the Capitol, I will have a legislator from either party, and frankly lobbyists too, come up to me because they have some concern about a family member and they want to know what to do. I know that it's hard to believe that children develop mental illnesses, but I have to tell you that it's harder to deal with your child who's been kicked out of several child care settings for their behavior. It's harder to deal with your child who's been suspended from school and placed in a separate classroom when they're only in third grade. It's harder to help your child who's wasting away and clearly is not eating. It's harder to call the police when your child is in such a rage that you're afraid that they'll hurt you. It's harder to learn from your son's college that they're sending him home and that he's hearing voices. And I know personally that it's harder to hold your middle school daughter in your arms while she drinks charcoal, knowing that she had so little hope for the future that she tried to take her own life by swallowing Tylenol and other medications. We don't want to believe that our children have these illnesses any more than a parent wants to believe that their child has cancer, but they do. And their symptoms are real, these illnesses are real, and every single parent struggles to find the best and the right treatment to help their child. Judith Warner, I don't know if you've seen this book. She's an author, and she writes frequently for the New York Times. She published a book called We've Got Issues. She started out determined to write a book about our culture of diagnosis and that what was behind all these kids' purported issues were parental and societal neuroses. She was going to explore fashionable kids' diagnoses such as autism and Asperger's and ADHD, oppositional defiance disorder, and anxiety. But as she started doing research and talking to families, she realized that she was wrong. Mental illnesses are real, she wrote, and the vast majority of kids don't get any help because there isn't money to pay for it and there's a shortage of practitioners to provide it. And she adds that they don't get it due to the pervasiveness of views like my former certitudes, the doubt that mental health problems are real, the aspersion cast on parents of children with problems, the confusion over what mental health disorders actually are, the tendency to conflate mental illness with bad behavior, and to see children symbolically as the designated patients in a culture we can all agree is pathological instead of as real people. Our children's mental health system is in the beginning stages, and we have made some incredible advancements. And if you turn to the color copies, which we didn't make a lot of because we are a nonprofit, you'll see that we tried to explain some of the issues. So we told you, what is a severe emotional disturbance? We're not just talking about a kid with a little bit of anxiety, but kids who are really, really struggling. How the mental health services are funded in terms of private insurance and medical assistance. You'll also see some of the basic clinical services, the community services and supports, and the hospitalization and residential treatment. And I think you'll note that, you know, these are the services that prevent kids from going into the higher cost services. And most of that middle column is funded with public dollars. You can see the cost comparison between community children's mental health services and hospitalization. Inpatient psychiatric hospitalization is roughly $2,500 a day. Versus providing children's day treatment at $88 a day. So if we can provide these intensive services, we save money. I also put together some charts from data from the department just showing that as the number of children in community mental health services has gone up, the number of children in residential treatment has gone down. We're also able to see the children's crisis response outcomes. When we've had kids where the crisis team has responded and intervened, we've actually been able to keep kids out of the hospital and out of emergency rooms, which, again, saves a whole lot of money. And I can tell you that it's really hard to place your child in a hospital. And if you can keep them at home, you would much rather do that. You'll see just in terms of even the primary reason for crisis response services, over 24% were suicidal thoughts. I mean, this is a really difficult thing. It's a really hard thing. You don't want to just kind of let that go. We also have information on the school-linked mental health services. And I think what's important here, too, is we have data from Hennepin County that shows that as the children receive treatment, the number of suspensions actually went down. So the more times that we can keep kids in school learning, the better outcomes that everyone has. I think what's most important to note is that children are resilient and they get better, and it's because of the treatment that we provide in the community. I want to tell you that my own daughter is doing better. Nearly 8 years later, she's a senior in college in Chicago. She uses the skills that she was taught in therapy to manage her anxiety and depression. She has a boyfriend, whom I like, and most importantly, she really has hope for her own future. The investments that were made with bipartisan support in 2007 are just now coming to fruition. An incredible amount of work went into developing recommendations to reform our mental health system, including lots of research and talking to other states. And what we have is a wonderful foundation to an effective community mental health system. We need to keep this foundation and build upon it so that all people whose lives are touched by mental illnesses, both children and adults, do not become disabled by their mental illness, but are able to live, work, and learn, and be active members of our community. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Just a question. I think in some ways you're presenting some contrast to the testimony that Dr. Ephraim just presented. I guess I would summarize what your point is, that that we are not, that screening is not a problem, essentially or generally, and that we need to continue to do screening, maybe more of it. Let me just, the graph that you presented here on page 4, your color sheet, talking about the number of children in community health services and the number of children in residential treatment. If you add the two together, in 2006, it would show that there were about 10,500 children in the combination of these two. In 2009, 3 years later, there's almost 17,000, which is very, very dramatic growth. If we take Dr. Ephraim's point, we could say, well, part of that at least is attributed to perhaps an overdiagnosis problem. Now, would you agree with that, or would you say there's something else going on that has resulted in such a, I mean, this is a relatively short period of time. If that's the trend we're on, we're in for real trouble here going forward. But what would you attribute the growth in those 3 years at that magnitude?
Mr. Chairman, I would attribute it to the fact that we had more services available. I mean, 2007 was when you enacted, you know, the Mental Health Initiative, so that we were able to fund things like, you know, crisis services and supports. So I think we've seen that we're able to intervene before kids get really, really ill. And before that, that was about the only thing that you had available. Now, this doesn't mean that all these children are necessarily on medications. And I will tell you that it is a very difficult decision for a parent to make. And we believe that you have to have quality in there. And I think that, you know, not having, I mean, my own daughter did not have access to a child psychiatrist until she had her suicide attempt. You know, and so, you know, I think that's one of the problems that we find is that you can't access the very people who can make a really good, excellent diagnosis and really come up with a good treatment plan. And I think that we're more likely to see that we don't use medications when, in fact, we do these kinds of things like the screening. I remember, and I don't have the data with me, but when then Ramsey County first started their screening, they were actually able, they did find kids who were on medication, and they were actually able to get them therapy and other things so that they could get off of the medication. So I think that, you know, we have to focus on quality, absolutely. Do I think that some children are receiving medication that they shouldn't? Absolutely. Do I think every child should have a good, thorough diagnostic assessment? Absolutely. But screening can catch things early.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, when you look at how many kids are getting screened, it's kind of like just feeling the leg of the elephant. You're not going to see the whole elephant. You really need to look at, after that happened, then how many of those kids are graduating from high school compared to previously? How many are staying out of juvenile corrections compared to previously? It isn't exactly like when a child is in trouble that something doesn't happen that costs money. Something will cost money. The question is what we're doing costing less money now than what it did before when we weren't providing early intervention services? What most people don't realize is that when a child is hospitalized, if a parent wants their child to stay in the state of Minnesota, you don't have a lot of choice about what hospital they go to or where their hospital bed will be located. You have to take what you can find, whatever is available. And when a child is hospitalized for mental illness, you don't get to choose their doctor. You have to take the doctor the hospital has. It won't be the doctor they had when they were in the community, because that doctor isn't recognized by that hospital. They have their own staff doctor. And then when the child is going to be discharged, if the doctor you had before is still available because you've discontinued services, then you can be discharged to that doctor. But sometimes you have to find a whole brand new doctor, and because there's such a shortage of child psychiatrists, it's almost impossible to find a new doctor. So anybody that wants to tell you that it's a walk in the park to try to help your child when they have mental illness hasn't experienced it.
Thank you, Senator Bertel. Are there other questions for the witness?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Appreciate your testimony. I do want to just circle back and were there questions from last week that we did not get to that members had? I know we were kind of rushed for time at the end, and I wanted to make sure people had questions that there. Senator Rosen, did you have some?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And it was on the on the expenditures of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. And so if somebody could address those.
I think we have somebody from the department here who we hope can address that. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Weiss. I'm the Acting Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Weiss. It's on the spreadsheet on page 6, and I don't know if anybody else still has it, but I just like to go through a few of the figures here. The annual placements in 2011 were 30,500, and they're projected to be 37,000 in 2015. But I'm looking at the administrative costs for 2011 is $2.85 million, and in 2015 it's $3.91 million. So we are talking a tremendous jump there, 1.1 at least, 1.1 million increase. And I'm just a little perplexed at, well, you could just go through all through the whole chart here from 2003 and going forward. The administrative costs are just astronomical. So I'm not sure if you can answer that question right now, Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen,
go ahead.
I will do my best to answer that question. What I understand is the annual placements is not related to the cost. The columns that I believe it's best to look at is the cost per placement, which is the next column, and the administration for the entitlement placements. Those are the two that correspond to one another. So as the and those two kind of line up. So if you have the cost per placement and the administrative costs, the tribes and counties get administrative costs to operate that fund. As you look at the annual placements, if you look at 2004 and then 2006, I think your question before is those go up and down, but in the administration for the entitlement places, they continue to go up. And the reason for it is that you may have placements that are more costly, higher placements, longer stays, and that's what corresponds to those two cost per placement and the administration, not the annual placement. So that's my understanding of how those interact with one another. In regards to your question about 2015, I believe part of that, and I could be wrong, is the Medicaid expansion will have more folks that will be eligible for the fund. So that's my understanding of those particular questions.
Well, Mr. Weiss, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Rosen.
I'm still having a little problem with the cost per placement then, if you want to just focus on that, because why are we seeing over, well, you know, it's about $800 increase, but your administration cost, that's where I would like to focus on, is the, in 03 it was 1.3, and in 2010 it's 2.5. And you only served, let's see, about 6,000 more people. Now, that's quite a bit. And so,
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, again, my understanding is that if they look at the intensity of the service that occurs during that time frame, I believe that accommodates for some of those costs. If you would like more information, I'll do my best to dig into this.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Weiss, I sure would appreciate that because I'm still not comfortable with the net state obligations in 2015 of $125 million and only serving 37,000 people. So,
thank
you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Maybe you could just tell us who receives these administrative dollars.
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, my understanding is that the administrative dollars are by the counties and tribes that administer the fund in terms of utilizing these dollars.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe it might be easier for Senator Rosen to get her question answered if she asked them to come and answer it rather than the department, since the department doesn't get the money for administering the fund, the tribes and counties do.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. But Mr. Weiss, I wanted to just pursue that a little bit. You mentioned in your remark just a few minutes ago that there was something about the intensity of the treatments and so forth, but isn't there a limit on what the amount of time that people can stay in treatment with these programs? Isn't there some parameters around this? And what is the department doing as it's looking at funding programs in this area? Do you look at what the costs are per treatment, or how do you gauge that, or how do you award the contracts, if you will, to vendors who are providing these treatments? I guess I have the same question, as it seems that historically, that even though there has been growth, obviously, in the number of placements, there's been a disproportionate rise in the cost to administer this, which I don't know what all the drivers are that are beneath that, but I would have thought that the structure would have put some limitation on what you're calling intensity, since these are not open-ended, I don't think, are they? They're defined to be a certain period of time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, when I relate to intensity, the fund looks at hospital-based programs, residential programs, and outpatient programs. So my understanding is that when you look at intensity, you could have individuals that may be in a higher-cost program for a longer period of time, such as the inpatient or hospital. There could be variations of folks being an outpatient for a longer period of time, which would be a lower cost. So that's my understanding of the difference between those costs and how it relates. And again, if I could get more information, I certainly will do so.
Well, and Mr. Weiss, I think we'd appreciate that, and I think Senator Berglund's suggestion might also be good for us to see if we can get some information from the counties as well. But do you, as the department, also look at what the results are of the placements and whether there are repeat replacements of the same individual? In other words, when you're evaluating and awarding contracts, are you looking at, well, here's a program that is showing this sort of performance versus here's one that's showing another kind of performance? How is that gauged? How do we know that this money is actually, I don't know what the right word would be, maybe cure isn't the right word, but is having the effect that we expect? How do we know that?
Mr. Chairman, the new rate methodology that we'll be implementing in July will give the department that opportunity to have oversight for monitoring of the placement agreements. Right now it's the counties that have that are the placing authority. So we certainly, and I agree, need to have more monitoring, and that's what we plan to do. That's my understanding.
Well, and Mr. Weiss, I'm not trying to suggest we just need more monitoring for the sense of monitoring. I'm just trying to get at, if we're treating people, there should be some expectation of what we're hoping to see the result, and there should be some linkage between the increasing funding and better results. If we're seeing increasing funding and no change in results or a reduction in results, then that would call into question the structure of the program. Is that kind of analysis being done?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Gene Anderson. I'm the supervisor for the Treatment Services section of the Department of Human Services Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. In answer to some of your questions, yes, there is outcome data on all of our programs is posted on the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division's website. The length of stay or the cost that's paid for each treatment is identified. Initially, the need for treatment is identified in a multi-level client assessment that assesses each individual's six dimensions of their life, from medical conditions to living conditions, severity of their addiction, and that is something that's monitored on a weekly basis by whatever program that the client is involved in. That's the determination for their length of stay based on if they have made enough improvements for them to move on to either a different level of care, as Mr. Weiss had spoken about, or be discharged into their home community.
And so, Mr. Anderson, thank you for so you're saying the department does have information about the performance of the programs that you could present to the committee?
Yes, we have it on a public website. We began monitoring each program's outcomes and their indicators if the clients are making progress on different social and psycho scales in their lives.
Okay. Well,
in addition to that, we do have information about the amount of persons that complete treatment and the amount of persons that receive more than one treatment or not.
And Mr. Anderson, is this information used then by the department for purposes of determining which grants to make going forward, or how is the information that you're talking about used by the department?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we don't make grants in terms of the treatment process. Currently, the counties are the ones that are actually the gatekeepers for assessment and for treatment placement. We fund in conjunction with the county and with state federal block grant dollars through the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. We are the actual payers of the treatment. It's actually based on a contract that currently the counties are holding with each of the providers, and the tribes are holding with the providers, and the managed care organizations are holding with the providers. What Mr. Weiss alluded to is that beginning in July, we're hoping through our rate methodology, through the prodding of both the legislature in 2009 and the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Substance or Services, that we would hold that contract and then set together performance indicators and provider agreements that we would hold.
Senator Berglund, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I've been trying to get to happen for at least 10 years now is to get more programs licensed and funded that are for dual diagnosed people with mental illness and chemical dependency, because there's quite a few people like that. And, you know, they tend to get the runaround, is the way I would put it. You know, they're told by the mental health professionals they can't be treated until they get their chemical dependency treated, and they, you know, they're abusing chemicals because they aren't getting their mental health taken care of. So I've wanted to see more providers who were dually licensed and treating people for both illnesses at the same time. So my question is, how many of those do we have now?
Mr. Anderson or Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senator Berglund, I believe currently we have about 54 programs that are indicated in their license to meet the criteria for co-occurring services disorder through the Minnesota Licensing Division. Part of the rate reform process is that because it's been such a unidentified and unindicated process for a program to become eligible to be meet the criteria for serving persons that have comorbidity, we're putting forth a more clear description of what those are and hoping to move through the rulemaking process in the next year or two to actually become more clear in terms of what's actually identified for a program that can treat persons that have both mental illness and chemical dependency.
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up. So if there are 54 that are licensed, would I assume then that there are 54 that are actually treating people for both diagnoses?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I'm not exactly sure the number, but I would say that those that are identified are believing that they are serving co-occurring disorders. The problem with that is the ability to go from treating a single disorder for substance abuse and adding the comorbidity does not hold a lot of additional requirements.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could just ask for you to get me more definitive information on that.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Senator Berglund that we need more programs that do dual diagnosis, because we've come a long way just in realizing what it takes for a treatment program to work. Because obviously the figures show that in the past here we've just been paying for the 10th, 12th, 13th treatment program, and hopefully that 14th treatment program is going to work. And we have set the treatment programs up for failures in many times, because we don't address the entire scope of the picture and don't give it a long enough breadth of ability to work. And we do need to focus on the outcome measures and performance measures. I mean, and so as as a department, Mr. Weiss and Mr. Anderson, what are you doing to make sure that these treatment programs are going to be successful so we can mitigate and hopefully adjust some of these figures and have programs? Maybe we don't need 54 programs. Maybe we only have 30, but they all show performance measures at the very end. That's what I would like to see, and treat the chemical and mental health issues along with these problems. So these figures are astounding, I think.
Senator, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, that's part of the process in the rate reform activity is to focus on the state being the monitor of those programs with clear identified indicators on the front end. Currently I think the number of folks that receive more than one treatment episode, or I should say people that receive one treatment episode, which could be from going from through a inpatient program or part of an inpatient and then into a halfway house program, it's 99% of the folks that are going into treatment in Minnesota are going through one episode like that, 99% of them. But I think you're right, is the reason the ones that aren't is because the services aren't matching their need.
Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
Just that I'd like to have the information distributed that Senator Berglund requested, and I suspect everybody on the committee would like to have that.
Thank you. And Mr. Anderson, if you get that information to us, we'll make sure committee members receive it. Thank you. Are there any other questions for our witnesses? Thank you. I think that we may have need for further information from the department as we go forward in looking at the budget, so I appreciate your willingness to come back today. Thank you. And I would like to invite not sure if we have a name, but from the sex offender program, if you could come forward and introduce yourselves and turn it over to you.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Starkamp, the Deputy Director of Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Janine Hebert. I'm the Executive Clinical Director of MSOP.
And I'll I didn't quite catch your name. Could you?
Janine Hebert, H-E-B-E-R-T.
Mr. Chair and members, we're going to be going through a short PowerPoint slide presentation. It should be up just momentarily. There we go.
And Mr. Storkamp and Ms. Hebert, is this the information that we have in our packet?
It is.
Thank you. So members, you should have a packet that has the slides, I believe, in the presentation.
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate us coming here today, and some of you have heard our spiel in various forms and other settings, and some of you we may be new to, so I appreciate your focus and attention. We're going to breeze through some slides that address the treatment and some numbers, and we can take questions at the end, if that's okay with folks. As a review for some of you, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is charged with treating individuals who have been civilly committed as sexually dangerous persons.
Excuse me, could I just ask you to make sure the microphone is brought close so that we can pick up your voice on the tape?
Is that better?
That's better.
Thank you. That MSOP treats individuals who are either sexually dangerous person or sexual psychopathic personality. It's referred to as SDP or SPP. In Minnesota, there are other types of civil commitments. We have a mentally ill, mentally ill and dangerous, chemically dependent, or MR. And we fall under the same statute, which is 253B. But the individuals we'll be talking about are SDP and SPP. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program has two sites. We have one up north in Moose Lake and one down in St. Peter. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how the differences between those programs in a moment. The civil commitment process has several groups that are a part of it. Initially, unfortunately, sex offenders come from communities, and they are convicted and go to corrections. And the Department of Corrections are where we get our referrals from. Department of Corrections makes referrals to the counties, the county of commitment, the county of where the offense occurred. It's up to those counties whether or not they make that a commitment to our program. The courts determine who comes to MSOP, and the courts also determine who leaves MSOP and when, and we'll talk about that in a moment. MSOP's piece to the civil commitment process is the treatment. And then, of course, there's the statutes and laws that come from the legislature with guide civil commitment in Minnesota. This slide is a snapshot of just grounding us in sexual abuse in general. If you take a look at the horizontal line up on top, and you imagine that that's all sexual abuse occurrences in Minnesota, about 80 to 90% of sexual abuses go unreported. So the ones that we know about are just really a drop in the bucket of what is really happening with regard to sexual abuse. So in order for someone who committed an offense to come to the light of MSOP, someone who's been victimized or a person who's aware of that incident needs to report that. The incident needs to be investigated. It needs to be substantiated. It needs to be charged. And then it needs to be convicted. So that's the funnel of individuals who become registered sex offenders in Minnesota. Minnesota's philosophy has been generally to manage sex offenders mostly in the community. At a snapshot in time, the bottom horizontal line, about 80% of registered sex offenders in Minnesota are currently residing in the community. They either committed their offense and were placed on probation, or they went into prison and are now out on intensive supervised release. About 15% are currently in prison, and MSOP has between 2 and 3% of all registered sex offenders. So while we have the individuals who are most likely to reoffend, there's a lot of registered sex offenders in Minnesota that never come to MSOP. This next slide just is a description of the civil commitment process, the way it's set up currently in Minnesota. As I mentioned, the Department of Corrections makes referrals to the counties. The program up north in Moose Lake, we have a unit of individuals in our admissions unit who are still in the legal process. They haven't yet been finally committed. So individuals, the courts go through the process, and they're initially committed. Minnesota is the only civil commitment program that has a two-step civil commitment process. We have an initial commitment, and then 60 days later, the courts take a look at that individual to see if they still meet that level of criteria for commitment, and then they're finally committed. And that's inherited mostly from the other commitment types in Minnesota. If someone is psychotic and they meet the criteria for perhaps MI commitment, in 60 days, they could be placed on medication successfully and then no longer meet that commitment criteria. But it doesn't make sense as much for our population. It's a bit of an inefficiency because most of our clients, if they're a sex offender 60 days later, they'll probably still meet that criteria as a sex offender. For those who are finally committed, they go through treatment at either Moose Lake or St. Peter. And then the end process of the civil commitment process is that individuals can petition to the special review board every 6 months for decrease in custody, provisional discharge, or full discharge. And the special review board makes recommendations to the Supreme Court Appeals Panel, or called SCAP, and that three-judge panel are the individuals that determine whether there's a placement outside the fence, whether someone's provisionally discharged or fully discharged. And that's how, when we say courts in, courts out, this is the illustration for it. So I'm just going to talk briefly about what treatment looks like in MSOP. We don't cure individuals. We don't pretend to think that we can cure individuals. We provide treatment, and we address dynamic risk factors, and we assist in managing risk, just as with folks who have mental illnesses or are chemically dependent. It's one day at a time, and an individual needs to work the program that they have in front of them. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program is cognitively behaviorally based, which is research influenced and driven. We have three phases to the program. We have about an 80% participation rate. You can't make somebody participate in treatment. 80% participation rate is really quite high for the other 19 civil commitment programs in the country and the Fed program. There's 21 programs in all. The first phase of treatment is to assist someone in their, what we call their exoskeleton, and maintaining good behavior. Can they follow the rules? Phase two takes a look at the underlying issues in their offense, and phase three talks about their maintenance plan and assisting them going out into the community successfully, not reoffending. We do use polygraphs to assist in treatment at all phases. We do psych testing and we do physiological assessments, including the PPG and the ABLE. So we don't rely strictly on individual self-report. I'd like to believe our clients are honest with us throughout their treatment process, but in fact, we look for objective data to support their self-report. The difference,
Can I interrupt you for 1 second, Ms. Abert? This treatment that you've described, how effective is it? Do you keep, I assume you do, keep track of what is it called recidivism in this program and what that rate is, and how effective is this treatment regimen that you're describing?
Mr. Chair and members, not having an individual who has been through the treatment program and successfully in the community, we don't have what's called an N for research to know of this program specifically. There are some fairly robust studies about sex offender treatment efficacy, including one that was done by the Department of Corrections in-state in Minnesota, as well as through ATSA, the Association for Treatment of Sexual Abusers, which does indicate that individuals who successfully complete treatment are less likely to reoffend. We don't have it down to the science of MSOP, obviously. The trick with recidivism rates with regard to treatment, in my opinion, is that there's a very low base rate for sex offenders to recidivate. They don't reoffend at a very high rate naturally without an intervention. So in order for the intervention to be successful, you're going from a 10% recidivism rate to an 8% recidivism rate, which some people may say that isn't enough of a significant treatment effect. I would argue that for someone who's been sexually victimized, if we prevent one sex offense, that would probably be a different measure. So we don't have the numbers for MSOP specifically, but I can provide some research data which talks about sex offender treatment in general, which is research-based, and this program is based on those types of programs.
So just for clarification, to make sure I understand what you're saying, that generally sex offenders have a low recidivism rate, generally. Is that correct? And
yes,
I assume that would depend on, I know there are different levels and categories of offense, and I would assume that there's high recidivism perhaps in a few, and most of the rest have relatively low.
That's accurate.
But not all sex offenders are in your program. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so what you're saying is that for you to look at specifically what you do in the MSOP is difficult since there is not, a large enough database or enough history with this to really determine whether this is how effective it is. Is that correct?
Precisely.
Thank you.
The best we can
Mr.
do is
Chair?
Compare ourselves to other civil commitment programs with the understanding that it's a different legal bar in each state with who is civilly committed. And we do know that other civil commitment programs average 8 to 10 years of treatment before someone gets out. And we know that less than 10% of all civil committed sex offenders in the country are out. So we can sort of do those as bars as well.
Thank you. And Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Dr. Hebert or Ms. Hebert?
It's Ms. Hebert, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Hebert, so the 10% number, the likely to reoffend number, is likely to be the people who are not committed to MSOP. Is that correct?
Ms. Hebert.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, it's a little more complicated that the term sex offender is a legal term, and so it's not a psychological term. And so when the studies look at sex offenders, they're looking at the heterogeneous group of all sex offenders. So you'll see studies that will say that there is a range of 3 to 15% recidivism of sex offenders. But keep in mind, like the chair said, the clients at MSOP are at the farthest end of that spectrum and are, by the courts, determined highest risk to reoffend. So what we could do is we could take a look at all of MSOP's clients and look at their actuarial scores on risk assessment, and that would give us an idea of the group of risk that they fall into. But there's no science that tells us about specific individuals. It only tells us about factors of groups of offenders.
And Ms. Hebert, just to, I hope, clarify this a little bit, the length of time that you've been operating the program, do you have any data about clients in the MSOP program who have been released and then reoffended again? I mean, do you have data on that, just your own historical data, whether or not that's descriptive of any trend or not, I don't know, but do you have that kind of information?
Mr. Chair, members, there hasn't been anyone who's been released from MSOP that has stayed out in the community, so that makes it tricky.
So it would be zero then, wouldn't it?
It's a baseline to start from, yes.
All right, okay. Thank you.
Certainly. Here's a, and I'll breeze through this so you can get to Mr. Storkamp. I'm sure we have numbers questions as well. This is a slide that helps illustrate the difference between the sex offender treatment programs that happen in prison, we call them SOTPs, and MSOP. Because MSOP is designed as a treatment program, our treatment occurs 24/7. So it is not just what the individual does in a two-hour treatment group. We take input from staff throughout MSOP for feedback on what their behavior looks like in all other settings. These are individuals who have demonstrated their ability to be very violent and damage other people's lives. We're not going to rely on how they're doing in treatment groups exclusively. So we get feedback to how they're doing on their job. How are they doing with their female history teacher in education class? How are they doing at the basketball court? Can they associate with peers their own age? For someone who's a pedophile, that's a pretty tricky challenge, and it's part of their treatment plan. So this is just a snapshot to remind people that while we do do groups and we do individual sessions, that we also rely on the ears and eyes of everybody else to make sure that clients are doing demonstrated meaningful change in all areas and not just in treatment. The two sites that I spoke of earlier, Moose Lake and St. Peter. Moose Lake has a different mission from St. Peter. That is our reception facility. That's where clients come in who, as I mentioned, are still in the legal process. There's two main buildings up at Moose Lake, and you're welcome to come visit your local civil commitment program anytime you'd like. We have 25-bed program in what we call the main building, and those 25-bed units are some specialty programming. We have one unit for individuals with severe persistent mental illness, SPMI. We have one unit for individuals who have been committed up through the juvenile system. These are young men who are profoundly institutionalized, and they would also be vulnerable, quite honestly, to some of our other populations. So their programming is separate. We have a unit that we call the assisted living unit. Because we haven't released anybody, these individuals are aging. These are clients who need extra care. They're not quite at the nursing home level of care, but they also can't be programmed in regular programming units. We have a behavior unit for individuals who aren't behaving themselves temporarily and then move them back into treatment. Out on our new building, we have a 400-bed capacity. We have two wings that are 98 beds and three wings that are 68 beds. They look very different from the 25-bed units. And out in the main building is where we have a unit of our non-participants, individuals who are choosing not to participate, the admissions unit, and then conventional programming. I'd also just highlight that up at Moose Lake, we have a collaborative program, which is a unique venture from any other states, quite honestly. And it's a 50-bed treatment program located in the prison in Moose Lake, and it's staffed by MSOP staff. So it is provides treatment for individuals who come into corrections who look like they will be referred for civil commitment, and the hope being that they can do their treatment cheaper per bed in corrections and avoid perhaps civil commitment, or if they are civilly committed, they can start treatment further down the pike with us when they do come and transferred over. And then the St. Peter campus has a different mission. It is located on the same campus as the security hospital down in St. Peter. We have a razor wire around the two buildings that are MSOPs. And down at St. Peter, we have the programming for what we call our alternative clients, which are individuals with compromised executive functioning, low functioning, traumatic brain injury, neurological conditions, something that prevents them from being successful in regular programming. They do all their treatment down in St. Peter. And then we have our reintegration or individuals who are furthest along in treatment. And then I'll have one more slide and I'll be done. This is the step-down slide that illustrates where folks are at in treatment. So as I mentioned, if you look at the step on the left, our admissions unit, they come in the door at Moose Lake. They go through the first two phases, approximately, up at Moose Lake in treatment. If they're successful, they progress down to St. Peter to do their later stages of treatment. When they're down in St. Peter, an ankle bracelet is placed on them because they can begin to achieve privileges if they're in the later stages of treatment. So they can walk on campus escorted with staff. They can go in the community escorted with staff. And then ultimately, they can walk around on campus unescorted by staff, under supervision, with an ankle bracelet. In order for the clients to be placed outside of the secured perimeter in what we call the community preparation services, they need to go through that process I described, the SRB into SCAP. So the courts place them in that less secure environment. And according to the slide, you'll see that number 7. We currently have 7 clients in MSOP who are residing down in St. Peter on the same campus, but in housing that is located outside the secured perimeter. Of those individuals, the next step for them, again, they would go through the court process, is to petition to the courts for provisional discharge and then ultimately full discharge. So we have no one currently on provisional discharge, which would be our start for our study when we can see efficacy rates. So I'll let Mr. Storkamp complete.
And Mr. Chair and members, for this slide, one thing to keep in mind, a couple of years ago, we only had one person in the CPS program, and today, of the seven, we've got two that are petitioning to go out to provisional discharge at this time. So we've seen some movement through the program, and we're going to be excited about our first provisional discharge. To put Janine's treatment program into kind of context with some numbers, the first step, as she mentioned, is who gets referred to the courts. The chart that you see here are the number of referrals from the Department of Corrections to the courts. You'll see in 2003 that there was a dramatic increase. At that time, we had a tragic case in Minnesota, the Drew Shedin case, that the system actually responded and made adjustments to, and you'll see in a moment how that impacts on MSOP. But you'll see in the last couple of years, we're leveling off between 110 and 125 in that range for referrals. On the left side of the chart, and the black numbers are actual population. In 2000, July 1st, there's 149 clients in MSOP. July of 2010, 575. Today, we've approached over 600. 605 as of January 1st. And the right numbers are projections moving forward. Projections are based on current laws, current trends, and current practices. So it's really, what is the system going to be if absolutely no changes occur and things stay as is? We're anticipating about 50 beds per year, just over, as an increase moving out. At this rate, by July of 2013, MSOP will be out of existing beds, and we'll be looking to the legislature for other options. And those options have been kind of submitted in a report to the legislature.
Mr. Storkamp, can I just interrupt you for a second here? This trend is a little alarming. I've not seen anybody in the presentations I've heard from the state demographer that show the population growth at these rates. What is driving the growth here? Is what's happening that is seemingly presenting a pretty rapid rate of increase on a population that isn't growing nearly that fast? What's going on?
Mr. Chair and members, it's an excellent question. Remember, MSOP doesn't decide who comes to us or who leaves from us. It really comes from the courts. So it's really a driver by the courts and the number of clients that are coming through the system. As I showed from the previous chart, when referrals actually went up to the counties from the Department of Corrections and counties took another look at individuals and they put more people through the court system, the end result was a change in our population and dramatic growth. You've seen a leveling off between 2000 and 2003 previously because referrals were between 10 and 15 per year. When they jumped over 150, 100 to 150 range, that's when you're starting to see our increases pretty dramatic. If those referrals continue, if the courts review in those cases, as well as the county attorneys bringing forward, continue at those same rates, that's really the system being driven by this. One other piece of this I think that's real critical to remember, there's 2,800 individuals at the Department of Corrections today for sex offenders, either as a primary or secondary offense, that will be reviewed when they get close to the end of their their sentence. And approximately between 10 and 15% of those individuals are ultimately civilly committed, looking at the last couple of years' data.
What was that percentage?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understood. This number in the Department of Corrections that have been committed of a sex offense, the 2,800, I think, was the number that you gave. Is that number changing?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon. The number is fairly consistent at the Department of Corrections. They've seen some decreases in the overall releases, and as such, our numbers actually have decreased as well. They used to be 60 to 70 per year being released, and now it's 50 to 60 per year being released. So our numbers are adjusted annually to account for any of those adjustments that we're seeing from Department of Corrections numbers.
Thank you. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. I think also, in this context, I think all of these numbers are put together under today's construct, and that's kind of what comes to the legislature. The courts do decide today in and out, and the department is right now finalizing a report of alternative options that we might look at to change that curve, but there's really nothing that the department or the agency or the courts really would want or would be able to do without us taking a real look at this this persistent growth, and looking seriously at what funding makes the most sense in terms of managing the risk of sex offenders across the state. And so it's something that we'll have to spend a good deal of time on. I look forward to the finalized report and taking a serious look at all of the options that are laid out in there, and thank the department for their efforts in providing us with some insight.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. And Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. I just want to make sure that my understanding is what you're communicating to this. When we're talking about treatment of a, it's 80% aren't even in your system, right? That's a whole nother treatment system or a whole nother process that's out there. And that's the reoffender number that you have is based on that, since we don't have any data for the impact of our efforts at the civilly committed. You're here talking about the civilly committed. And so what we're talking about here, if we say, when we get ready to be able to do some evaluation and we're trying to address, is the treatment working, and what the measure of that would be, my understanding is that what we're talking about as a clinician, what we're talking about is something very different than my clinical understanding of does the treatment work, does the biochemical intervention work. What we're talking about is being able to evaluate, there'll be a baseline of risk because there are factors that are persistent, constant. They never can go away. And then there are some other factors that you measure that tell you not so much are they cured as whether or not we've been able to address through the treatment process risk factors. So our measure really is about managing, can we manage the risk factors adequately to take the risk to allow the person to move into the community. Is that correct? Is that what we're talking about, not a cure?
Mr. Zorkamp or Ms.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon.
Ms. Agar.
Exactly. That's what we're talking about. I would say that as clients progress through treatment, and what you're referring to is the difference between static factors, which don't change, and dynamic factors, which do change. Someone's heinous description of their offense is a heinous description of their offense, whether they're treated or not. That's a static factor. Dynamic factors are their ability to control their emotions, their ability to control impulsivity. That's what we target in treatment. As clients move through our treatment program, there are less incidents of assaults. There's less incidents of acting out in group. There's less incidents of isolation, of sexually acting out. So that tells me that treatment is working for individuals as they're going through the program. So those dynamic factors is what we would continue to manage through supervision and treatment when someone's placed out in the community.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you're running short of time. I got a couple last slides.
All right, go ahead.
Just to put in context, budget for MSOP is $67.4 million, but as you can see in 2008, or fiscal year 2008, we've made adjustments to the program, both in terms of moving into a new building, as Janine talked about earlier, as well as making continuous improvements and some changes to the program. We were able to reduce our annual budget by $10 million in base funding. What you're seeing in fiscal year 10 to fiscal year 11 is really only an increase for the anticipated growth in the population as we move forward. What this does for our per diem is it actually lowered our per diem significantly. It went from $387 a day down to $328 a day. One piece that's, I think, real critical here is as we add a new person to our building or our program, we're only bringing people on at $144 a day. That's our marginal per diem or the cost of bringing that person on. Therefore, each person we bring on will lower our per diem overall. It is going to cost additional dollars overall. In comparison to other states range from $100 to over $500 a day. But again, it really is a difference in how the civil commitment programs operate and the law surrounding that. Everyone's is different. Just putting in
context. Just one second, Senator Marty.
Thank you. On that point, the marginal per diem, I mean, is that until we need to build a new prison, a new... Not prison. A new treatment center. Or is that just going to continue that way because somehow or another the larger population brings it down that much?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the $144 is really based on looking over the next couple of years within our existing facilities. And if we are going to need additional security staff beyond that and physical plant bonding would be separate from this cost. This is strictly just operating, so it's a new clinical team for X number of clients. It's a new security for the design as well as the food, records, those type of things for the individual clients.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the last slide that we've got here is really a breakdown of our per diem. There's actually two components to this. The top half is our operating per diem. This is where you see the $67.4 million. This is the general fund dollars that come directly to the program. But by statute, we've got to present a fully loaded per diem. And what we mean by that is it also includes the indirect and bonding cost. Indirect costs are really related to the building and capital asset depreciation, as well as the bonding cost are for the additional facility that came online. That's amortized over several years and then factored into the overall cost. So you can see that our operating cost is really $302 per day. The fully loaded cost is $327 per day, and that's based on an average population of 612 over that fiscal year. And I'm sure you'll get into more discussions as we move into the budget and the requests that we'll be bringing forward.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hebert and Mr. Storkamp, for coming by this this afternoon. It was very informative and concise. I appreciate that. And I'm sure we'll have further need to seek your advice as we go forward. But thank you for coming today. Appreciate
well, thank you,
it very
Mr.
much.
Chair, and available for other questions outside as well.
Thank you. And members, with that, we are adjourned until tomorrow morning.